WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new Cold War between Russia and the West, according to my guest, Edward Lucas. It's not about arms or ideology. This new Cold War is fought with cash, natural resources, diplomacy, and propaganda. Lucas says that the new Cold War is in part a struggle for market share. Russia is building up its clout as an energy supplier. It wields its energy weapon to bully its enemies and bribe its allies, and uses its financial clout to buy friends and influence. The big strategic worry used to be the Soviet Navy's capacity to blockade Europe's sea lanes. Now, he says, it's the Russian gas company Gazprom's ability to block access to its gas pipelines. Lucas has covered Eastern Europe for The Economist for over 20 years and was a longtime witness to the Cold War. He campaigned in the early 80s for Poland's Solidarity Trade Union. He studied German in a divided Berlin and studied Polish in communist Poland. He covered Czechoslovakia's Velvet Revolution. Edward Lucas's new book is called The New Cold War, Putin's Russia and the Threat to the West. How do you think the Kremlin is now using oil to leverage global power?
Well, the main thing that oil and gas bring is money. That the Kremlin, when Mr. Putin took it over, was almost bankrupt. They just had a horrible economic crisis. There'd been a devaluation. They defaulted on a lot of their debts. And Russia really looked like an international laughingstock. It was all through the 90s we'd kept Russia going with loans from the IMF, loans from the World Bank, loans from Western governments. And then suddenly the oil price went shooting up. It was under $20 when he came into the Kremlin. It's nearly $100 now. And that brings in a huge stream of cash, which enables them both to cover up the underlying economic problems in Russia and also to pursue a much more confident and assertive foreign policy. Then there's a second dimension to this, which is the gas pipelines, on which the Kremlin has a monopoly of east-west gas pipelines, allow them to exert pressure very specifically on countries in Europe. So they can say to the Georgians or to the Ukrainians or to the Poles or to the Estonians or Latvians or Lithuanians, if you do things that we don't like, we can just cut your gas off. And even the threat of that is quite a powerful one. What they tend to try and get is the local gas industry. So they've already taken over the Belarusian gas industry. They're trying to take over the Ukrainian gas industry. They want to take over a chunk in Germany as well. They have very close links with the German gas industry, and they've bought into the Italian one. So they're using the gas exports as a way of levering their way deep into Western markets to consolidate their hold there.
And so one of your points is that if the West buys gas from Gazprom, it's kind of buying into this controlling system.
Exactly. I mean, we're letting ourselves be sucked into this monopolistic and highly politicized gas business. Now, I'm not against trade with Russia. I think it's completely normal we should buy gas from Russia, but we should also make sure that Russia needs us as a customer more than we need Russia as a supplier. And there's something quite absurd about the fact that the European Union, which is so rich and so big, so much more attractive than Russia, so much stronger than Russia, really, is pathetically trying to do individual gas deals on a country-by-country basis with the Kremlin. The Kremlin should be coming to Europe and saying, please, can we be one of your gas suppliers because you're rich and we need your money? But instead, it's the other way around. We're going to the Russians queuing up and saying, please, can we the Germans, we the Austrians, we the Dutch, we the Italians, we whoever, please, can we have a chunk of the gas pie? And that's a very odd asymmetry which the Russians are exploiting very well.
Well, you're concerned about the Russians exploiting the West as gas and oil customers as opposed to, say, Saudi Arabia?
The places
we're getting oil from are not exactly like paragons of democracy.
Mm, absolutely. But, I mean, there's a huge difference between gas and oil because oil comes in tankers, and if country X decides that if Venezuela says we're not going to sell oil to the Americans anymore, okay, it may send the price up $10, $20, even $30 a barrel, but in the end there are other places that sell you oil. Natural gas comes mostly by pipeline. And if the pipeline is turned off, it's very difficult in the short term to get gas from anywhere else. And Europe's in the position that it doesn't have good alternative gas suppliers. We've been trying, with the help of the American government, to build a new gas pipeline which goes through the Balkans, through Turkey and into Central Asia. That's called Nabucco, after the opera. But this is an opera with a pretty tragic ending, in fact, because we haven't managed to get the pipeline built, and Russia has managed to destroy the coalition of countries that was trying to build that. So the European Union's attempt to diversify gas supplies, which was done with American help and consumed a lot of political energy, has been pretty much hopeless so far. And that's a good example of how what seems like a rather boring business of gas pipelines actually has profound political effects.
Now, how have profits from gas and oil changed the lives of people living in Russia?
Well, it's important to remember that the 1990s were a really dismal, chaotic, alarming, even humiliating time for Russians. And so even the rather bad government, I think, of Mr. Putin, quite incompetent government, is seen as a great welcome contrast, because Russians' living standards have gone up consistently since 2000. In crude terms, they're five or six times higher, nominal cash terms. And the Russian economy has grown very strongly. Foreign investments flooded in. Foreign reserves are bulging. Access to imported goods has gone up hugely. And so for most Russians have never had it so good, really, at any time in Russian history. And there's a tremendous feeling of relief about that. You know, for the Russians, the 1990s were like the Great Depression and the aftermath of the American Civil War combined, the feeling of complete dislocation and humiliation. Nobody knew what was going to happen tomorrow. And Putin's brought this, I think, rather phony stability and this rather phony prosperity, but it's still something that Russians appreciate very deeply.
What freedoms don't Russians have right now?
Russians don't have the freedom to make effective political choices, and they don't have the freedom to turn to political institutions for constraint and redress of the people in power. Basically, Russia has turned into a kind of Hobbesian society where the rich get everything they want and the poor put up with what's left. Now, I'm not saying things were perfect under the Yeltsin years. The court system was pretty rudimentary, the media was corrupt and often very sensationalist, and politics was extremely rough and ready. But at least there was a feeling of unpredictability and openness, that there was a chance that if something went wrong, you could do something about it. And those freedoms have really been closed down now. You can't make your voice heard through an election because it's so difficult to register a political party. And even if you've managed to do that, you won't get anywhere at the polls because the elections are rigged. You can't sue the government because the courts basically are part of the executive branch. You can't complain to the media because the effective media, the important media, which is television, is under government control, and so that won't work. You can't try to do anything through civil society because civil society groups are being harassed and closed down by the Kremlin. And it's pretty difficult to do it even just as an individual. And one of the tragic aspects of this is we're going back to the practice of incarcerating political dissidents in psychiatric hospitals. That was one of the most shameful and disgusting elements of the Soviet era. It's happening again now. I highlighted a few cases in my book, but since that was printed, there's been an absolutely outrageous case of a man in Tver, the town, Putin's hometown in a way, from out where his family comes from, outside Moscow, who was running a democracy citizens group and had been hauled off to psychiatric hospital nearly a month ago. And by the time of this, as this programme goes out, his family still don't even know what's happened to him or even what psychiatric hospital he's in.
My guest is Edward Lucas, author of The New Cold War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Edward Lucas, author of the new book, The New Cold War, Putin's Russia and the Threat to the West. And he's a correspondent for The Economist. He covers Eastern Europe. Now, in the old Cold War, Russia was a major military power. In what you describe as the new Cold War, do you see Russia as still a major military power?
It's only really a military power as far as nuclear weapons are concerned. It has a big nuclear arsenal, and that still matters. The surface navy is a pathetic shadow of its former self, with only 20 seaworthy big ships. the reform of the army has gone extremely slowly. It can barely win the war in Chechnya, let alone project power anywhere else. And the Air Force is still putting planes into the air, which in the United States would be in military museums, be in aviation museums. So from that point of view, it's not a threat. What is a threat is selling advanced technology to other countries. So there's a terrifying underwater rocket called the Shkval, which travels at hundreds of miles an hour in a cone of water vapor created by its special nose cone, and that could sink an American aircraft carrier. It's deeply worrying that they've sold this to the Chinese and may have shared the technology with the Iranians. So that sort of thing's worrying. But in the end, it's not really about that sort of hard power. I think the new Cold War is much more about the use of cash, about bullying, about clever use of diplomacy and propaganda.
Yet you write that Russia has started to flex its military muscles again, that it's suspended arms control agreements and has started sending its warplanes to probe the airspace of NATO countries.
Yes, I think that what Russia's very good at is doing convincing bluffs. You know, it's shaking the fist in the face to intimidate. Often makes people back down, even if there's not much muscle power behind that fist. And we in the West naturally flinch away from confrontation. We always try and split the difference and try and find a compromise solution. So if there's, for example, an attack on Georgia, we saw this in Georgia, a country which is very close to the United States, which the United States wants to bring into NATO and try to help. So we had a mysterious helicopter gunship attack on a village in Georgia. We had a plane of a kind that Georgia doesn't possess, firing a rocket of a kind that Georgia doesn't possess, near a new radar installation which the Georgians had put in with Western backing, clearly designed to intimidate Georgia. And in the end, the West couldn't work out what its united response was going to be. And so there was a very weak statement from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe saying we need to investigate this. But few Western countries came out and said, this is outrageous. What are you doing? This is clear provocation. Now, however, Russia's armed forces may be run down, but they're not so run down. They can't launch a few helicopters and go and shoot up a few buildings in a village somewhere. And that can then have a very good political effect, because they can see that the West is not really prepared to defend Georgia, and that means that they think next time we do something we can do rather more, and we now know that the West won't really get upset about it.
Elections are coming up in Russia in May. Constitutionally, Vladimir Putin is unable now to run for re-election. Some people have speculated he'll change the constitution to run for election. Other people have speculated he'll just be the power behind the scenes. What do you think are some of the possibilities?
I think the first point to make about the elections is that there's a real paradox that they're completely predictable and completely mystifying. And it's absolutely clear that Mr. Medvedev's going to win, and nobody has the faintest idea what it means, perhaps not even Mr. Putin and Mr. Medvedev themselves. Is Medvedev going to stay in office as the soft cop to Mr. Putin's hard cop? Is he just going to keep the presidential chair warm for a few years, or maybe only a few months, for Putin to return? Does he represent a real turning point? Is this the beginning of the liberal tide beginning to flow? He's certainly saying some very liberal things on the rule of law and political freedom and so on. We just don't know. And that really, to me, symbolizes what's wrong with the Russian political system, that we're trying to analyze it with the same sort of tools that we once used to use to try and work out what was happening inside the Kremlin. It's absolutely not open. The senior people there are not open to any sort of scrutiny, challenge, accountability. There's these huge set-piece press conferences every year where people get a chance to ask Mr. Putin a question. Nobody's had a chance to ask Mr. Medvedev a question. It contrasts very sharply for me with the American election campaign, which is so transparent and so unpredictable. And I really hope that Russians may be noticing the difference between their upcoming event, which I hesitate to call an election, perhaps it should be called voting or something less than election, and this fascinating political drama playing out in America.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Edward Lucas. He covers Eastern Europe for The Economist. His new book is called The New Cold War, Putin's Russia and the Threat to the West. Now, you write in your book that you grew up in an Oxford academic household deeply committed to fostering freedom of thought behind the Iron Curtain. Your father smuggled Plato's Republic and the Greek New Testament into communist Czechoslovakia. And I'm wondering, of all the books he could have smuggled, why did he choose those two?
Well, my father was an Oxford philosophy don, and they'd been contacted by the underground philosophy movement in communist Czechoslovakia. These were people who had been philosophy professors or classics professors who'd lost their jobs after 1968, after the Soviet-led invasion that had crushed the Prague Spring. And they were working as stokers and window cleaners and doing very menial jobs, but they were trying to maintain a tradition of independent philosophical studies. They would meet for seminars, often in the boiler rooms of hospitals or in workplace canteens after hours and so on, and try and have seminars and discuss these great questions that have been preoccupying great minds for thousands of years. And my father and other Oxford philosophers would go there as tourists, claim to be tourists, and would meet them clandestinely and would give seminars, take questions, read papers and so on. And of course there was one of the problems with the shortage of books, and that the communist authorities didn't allow people to buy Plato's Republic in either Czech or indeed in the original Greek. It just wasn't available, and the Greek New Testament as well wasn't available. So my father loaded up with other philosophical books as well, but I remember watching him packing his suitcase, and he said to me, until 1914, any time in European history from the Roman Empire onwards, it would have seemed completely inconceivable that someone from the University of Oxford would be needing to smuggle these books across the frontier between Austria and Bohemia. And this is what the Iron Curtain has brought us. And I was perhaps 12 or 13 at the time, but that left a deep impression on me, the idea that these ancient dusty books were so explosive that my father was risking his freedom in order to smuggle them to people who wanted to read them so badly that they were risking their freedom too.
So sum up for us, what do you see as being the threat that Russia poses to the West now?
The biggest threat is that Russia exploits our own weaknesses. If you believe that only money matters, then you're defenseless when people attack you with money. Ultimately, a free economy can't be divorced from a free society, and we need to get back a bit more of the moral clarity and self-discipline that we had during the Cold War to make sure that we win the next one.
So you think the West should use its economic leverage to pressure Russia to have what?
I don't think we can pressure Russia to do specific things anymore. I think what we can do is to show that they make some important symbolic and practical steps to say, if you want to do it that way, that's fine, but you can no longer do that with us. We need to say things like, Western capital markets are great places, but they're only for real companies. We need to say the Council of Europe and these other big international forums are very prestigious to belong to, but you have actually to believe in the principles that we stand for and also practice them. And if you don't, unfortunately, you can't be a member.
Edward Lucas, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It was a pleasure.
Edward Lucas is the author of The New Cold War. He covers Eastern Europe for The Economist.